Okay, would someone read for me verses 13 through 16, Matthew 5, 13 through 16. Ian, would you mind doing that for me?
Yes, sir. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven.
Okay, one of the things we're going to do as we go through this material is the things that we all understand fairly well, we'll probably not spend a great deal of time upon, so that we can go into a little bit more detail with regard to the more difficult passages. And I think this is one that we're pretty familiar with, the importance of being a good influence among those who are in the world. I just wanted you to note the characteristics of light and salt, which are the two metaphors that are used here, where we're told that we are the light of the world and we are the salt of the earth, that the two purposes of salt, as we typically consider it, is to flavor, but also to preserve. And I was reading a commentary just today in preparation for this class, and he emphasized that aspect of it, really something I hadn't thought too much of, the preservative nature. I'll just read you a quote. I believe his name is Curtis Pope, the Truth Commentary on Matthew. He says, "The Christian belongs to the world as its preservative agent, and to fail to serve this function is to reject the purpose and nature of a citizen of the kingdom." And I thought that was kind of interesting, because there are certain values and things that we ought to seek to preserve, things that that help us to maintain as a society, standing with God or God's pleasure. And it seems like the forces that are opposing that are vocal and ever-present. And so if we can, by our actions, because primarily when we talk about influence, the reference here is to how we conduct ourselves, if we can serve as a beacon to the world, or as a preservative in that sense, to where virtues that we consider to be important, such as kindness and meekness and gentleness and a loving disposition, those kinds of things, that might would be helpful to our society. Problem, I think, here, and why the exhortation is given, is that there are individuals who would name the name of Christ who wouldn't serve in that capacity. It's not so much that the world may not pay any attention, because much of the world won't, but the fact that we're abdicating a responsibility that we have if we do not serve as salt or serve as light. And the idea here is that if we don't serve as that flavoring and preservative to the world, then we are worthless. We're not worthy of anything at all. Of course, with regard to the light, there is that idea of enlightening, revealing, illuminating, but also the idea of guiding. And so when we talk about, again, our influence, it will help to show we people are to see Christ through us. And so our actions serve as a beacon of righteousness, of goodness, of the type of behavior that God expects us to have. But also it can serve as an example to lead others to that same place. And so the importance of that is extremely obvious, I think, to us. But individually, it's extremely important that we not abdicate our responsibility in the area of influence. So that's basically all that I wanted to note with regard to that particular section of Scripture. Anybody have anything that they want to add to that? Again, this is a section of Scripture I think everyone is pretty much familiar with. All right, then let us go ahead and go on, and that way we can get a little bit more covered in our discussion today. Someone, if you will, read verses 17 through 20 for me, please. 17 through 20. Anybody want to take your mind up? Appreciate it.
Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven, but whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Okay, good. Thank you. It's Matthew 5, verses 17 through 20. This section, if you'll notice, the Lord is saying his purpose is not to destroy the law. Why would he say that? It seems like it comes out of nowhere. It seems that there is a possibility that was a charge that was being raised already in his ministry, that his purpose was to destroy the law. And again, there is a distinction that needs to be made here, because he did indicate that the law would pass away. He indicated that his purpose in coming in this verse, verse 17 of the text, was to fulfill the law. And so the idea of this is that his purpose is not to in any way in destroying the law to indicate its lack of validity, its inherent lack of goodness, or the fact that it has no merit. That's not our Lord's intention. He was one who kept the law. He kept it diligently. He kept it perfectly. But the Old Testament itself, and we've discussed this, the book of Hebrews is a I think a fairly extensive discussion of that particular point. It wasn't intended to continue. It was a school teacher or a tutor to bring us unto Christ, as Galatians 3 tells us. And after we are, after we have received faith or come to faith, and we're no longer under the authority or auspices of that school teacher. And so the idea here is that he abrogates the law. He brings the law to an end. That's something that he did. Remind you of the text in John chapter 19 and verse 30, when Jesus had received the sour wine as he hung upon the tree. You'll remember on that occasion, and he said, "It is finished." And then he died. And what was meant by that phrase, "It is finished," is that everything that needed to be done, everything that he had to accomplish as Messiah to usher in his new kingdom, to usher in his new covenant, all of those things he had to do while he was on earth had come to an end. And it was at that point in time that he died. And so there is a difference between destroying and abrogating, or bringing it to an end. I'll just read you a quote that I came across. "To destroy would be to indicate the old law as having no merit. It would also make it of no use as a type," which was, of course, fulfilled in Christ as the antitype, and his covenant as the antitype. "But by fulfilling the law," he brought it to an end. He didn't destroy it. By fulfilling the law, again, he establishes the merit of that law, the purpose of that law, and it accomplishes what it was intended to accomplish. So there is that distinction. So whenever we look at the Old Testament, for individuals to say that it's wrong for us to say that the old law has come to an end is in fact wrong. It has been fulfilled. It has been superseded by another. But that in no way casts aspersion upon the goodness of that old law or the efficacy in accomplishing what it was intended to accomplish. And just as a couple of details, you'll notice in this text it says in verse 18 that one jot and one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. I used to think that the jot was the smallest letter, the tittle was a breath mark. And actually the phrases or the words are a little bit ambiguous. But that is the general idea that is given, that the jot is the smallest letter in the Hebrew language. It resembled a comma. And then a tittle is the smallest of marks. And just to kind of give and where I got this particular explanation, they use the reference to a serif. In your fonts that you have on your computer, you'll have serif fonts in sans serif fonts. And the sans serif or sans serif font means without serifs. And it is just the simple letters without any extra little squiggly lines on the ends to make it look pretty. And so a serif, just the smallest of things. Nothing in the law would pass away until all things are fulfilled. And that was his purpose. Now I want you to notice in contrast, Matthew chapter 24. We'll just go forward a little bit, and without going or delving deep into the context, because if we were to do that, then this is as far as we're going to get tonight. But I just want you to know the Lord's statement in verse 35, because there's an interesting contrast that he's given here. When Jesus speaks of his own words, he says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." And so there seems to be an indication of a difference in these two statements concerning the duration of these words and the authoritative nature of these words. The Old Testament was authoritative, but when Christ established his new covenant, which would even go beyond the existence of the physical universe, the old law came to an end and the new law superseded it. And but that's the point that is being said. So as far as the statement in that text as to why he said it, you'll remember that constantly Jesus was in conflict with the religious leaders who were claiming that he was either taking upon himself authority that he did not deserve, or taking issue with his treatment of the law. And so the claim that he was, his purpose was to destroy the law, may have been one that had been heard, which was the reason why this statement was made. That gets us through 17 through 19. Anybody have anything you want to add to that? Yes, Dick.
Yeah, on 18, where it says the law until all is fulfilled, is you brought about when he said it's finished and breathed his last. That's when it was fulfilled.
I mean, yeah, yes and no, in that sense. I mean, I recognize that there are other things that had to be accomplished. The prophecy concerning his resurrection, that on the third day he would raise, had not happened. I think that we can say from that is that everything, that the law was kept perfectly, and everything that he had to accomplish in his life as the Messiah to usher in that new covenant had been accomplished, and everything in the old
covenant.
Yeah, he nailed it to the cross, right.
That was before...
For his resurrection.
Well, that's
I understand
all figurative. We
yeah.
know.
Well, again, it's an indication of a taking away of one and ushering in of another, and that's certainly true. Carolyn?
So I know that like much of what you said is because of based on other passages and bringing them into this. I'm confused why Jesus decided to use the words until heaven and earth pass away, this law will pass away. Because when we hear until heaven and earth pass away, we think end of time.
Right.
So why did he say the law won't pass away until heaven and earth pass away?
That is an interesting thing, and that's the reason why I brought up that the text in Matthew 24, where that until one jot or one tittle will by no means pass till all is fulfilled. I think the idea is that the law would not come to an end or pass away prematurely. If it takes every jot and every tittle to be fulfilled in order for it to pass away at the right time, then it's going to remain, even if heaven and earth passes away, it's going to remain because that hasn't happened yet. So there are two clauses to be found here. And so it's going to remain and will stay until such time, even if the universe comes to an end, it's still going to remain until such time as it is fulfilled. Now, I think I think it was the response or answer to maybe accusations were being raised, as he's wanting to destroy it. No, I'm not going to destroy it. Yeah, it'll remain until such time.
So it's more like an idiom, sort of like over my dead body or something.
Yeah, something along those lines. But again, he understood and recognized that it was going to be fulfilled in just a few years. but he was just pointing that out. It's not destruction. I think that's where the contrast needs to be. Not destroying it, but fulfilling it. That's where the emphasis is. I'll never destroy it, you know, but it will be fulfilled when all is come to pass.
It's interesting in verse 19 there where he talks about relaxing part of the law, but still considering the person part of the kingdom. Now, I'm not sure how that...
Say that again.
Verse 19 says, "Therefore, whoever relaxes one of these, the least of these commandments and teaches it, will be called least in the kingdom of heaven."
Okay, you said the word relax.
On this one, yeah.
What version are you using?
ESV.
Okay, that's interesting.
Or the annuls. Annuls one of the least of these commandments. I guess annuls will be even more so. But it teaches it is to be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Like it's still, they're still included into the kingdom of heaven, even though they're...
Well, certainly, yeah.
What I understand, they're teaching it incorrectly. Whatever it is they're teaching.
See, you're getting into something I wasn't going
to
cover.
Yeah,
well, okay. We don't have to.
He's still talking about the law.
Yeah.
And the Jews under the law. So even
it's a
those,
part of their kingdom.
Right. Yeah. They'll always be part of that.
Jews, but not pleasing right. Jews, because they're breaking
right.
the commandments.
So they're still Jews.
The definition of the kingdom,
well,
that's what it is.
That helps, because that's what it's saying. Okay, so that'd be a good explanation. I want to get to verse 20 very quickly, because that is another interesting point. Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Since the scribes and Pharisees were very religious, how can our righteousness exceed theirs? That's one of the discussion questions in our material. Anybody want to?
Well, we got a lot of members of church today. They're like the Pharisees. They come on Sunday morning. They take the Lord's Supper. They put a little money in the deal. They've been seen of men, and as far as they're concerned, they've done what the law requires them. Now, if they want to exceed the righteousness of the Pharisee, they come on Sunday night and Wednesday night.
Okay, yeah, they got a wrong idea if that's what they're doing. Yeah, that's a good point to be made. Just to kind of cover what I'm talking about very quickly, when you look at the relationship that Jesus had with the Pharisees, it of course was a negative one. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is they were imposing human traditions. So they were exalting their own viewpoints and own traditions on par with God. And stated in chapter 23, verse 4, as heavy burdens, the phrase that is used there. They were ignorant of God's righteousness, as Romans 10 indicates. And then in Matthew chapter 23, it talks about the hypocrisy, that their righteousness was external, which is what Jerry was talking about, where all they were concerned with is what men saw them do, or the perception that men had concerning their righteousness and goodness. You remember the Pharisee that exalted himself, saying, "I'm glad I'm not like other men," as he stood in the temple and raised his voice to God. So that's the kind of idea that was present there. But having said that, as pious and humble children of God, how would our righteousness exceed the righteousness? What would be the distinction between what they do and what we are like? Because we too are to be consistent with regard to our obedience to the commands of God. Now we will stipulate that we should not bind traditions, so that's one thing, but what else?
Humility.
Okay, so let's think about, I mean, humility is a big part of it, because they were prideful. That was one of their problems, is pridefulness. But pridefulness is self-exaltation instead of submitting to God. I think that one of the things we want to emphasize here is that Christ demands a change of heart. And in fact, in the context of this passage, as we began talking about other things in verse 21, talking about murdering, don't murder. I say don't be angry. Don't commit fornication. I say don't lust. So it's not just an avoidance of maybe a physical sin and a surface obedience to the rituals or liturgy that is present religiously, but there must be a change of heart that basically transforms a person in his life. And that's something that it seems that the Pharisees often did not have, which is why they were called hypocrites in any number of texts where Jesus dealt with them. So I think the change of heart and mind is something that is evident, and something will be borne out as we look through the text.
You said something I'm just helping you to clarify. You say Christ demands a change of heart. You don't mean just Christ, God and the Old Testament, that as well?
Yeah. I mean, the Pharisees weren't keeping the law like they should have. But he's making that point. He's saying the Pharisees are the individuals that everybody looks up to. These are the righteous ones. These are the religious ones.
And
that's right. He said, you've got to be better than them. But that's kind of an indication that they're not pleasing God. And they certainly weren't. All right. Yes, Steve?
As you mentioned, the hypocritical righteousness that they had. And it seems like actually use a little bit of sarcasm there. Because you got to do better than their hypocritical righteousness that we got in. do better than that, can I?
Well, there was definitely an intended rebuke in regard to the righteousness of the scribes. Yeah, it was not a. He wasn't saying they were actually righteous. So, but it was that comparison between the two groups. That's the way they're the ones that are perceived as the most spiritually minded and righteous and obedient of all. And you're going to have to be better than that because they certainly are not. We discussed that. You had your hand up for a second. Anything else you want to add to this before we go on?
Yeah, it's already covered.
Okay, already covered. Let's go down to verses 21 through 26 then. And there are a number of things to discuss here, but the primary concept is that of anger that's under discussion. Dennis, would you mind reading for me? 21 through 26.
You have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar, and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge. The judge hands you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny."
Okay. Now, I want you to notice in this section, and it starts with verse 21, goes to the end of the chapter. But in verse 21, "you have heard," verse 22, "but I say to you." The same thing is repeated in verses 27 and 28, 31 and 32, 33 and 34, 38, and then 39 is a little bit different, "but I tell you," "but I say unto you," "I tell you," and then 43 and 44. So these are referred to by some as antithesis, where Jesus' teaching is contrasted with some other teaching or some other tradition or some other interpretation of teaching. So one of the things I want to note is that there is a view that exists today that Jesus in teaching was simply seeking to explain and correct misconceptions about the old law. He certainly does that here. But he was also dealing with rabbinical traditions and the which are exalted traditions from men rather than from God's word, and then misinterpretations of those commands that were given in Scripture. But he's also enlarging upon them, and he's establishing foundational teachings concerning his kingdom. If we're going to give a theme to the Sermon on the Mount, I think that's probably the way I would term it, is foundational teaching that Christ gives concerning his own kingdom. Miss Caroline?
Sorry if you...
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
I don't see it that way. It seems to me that he's just expounding on what he's just said about the Pharisees. "Unless you have heart," and this is how they haven't had heart. They said, "Don't learn to your brother," but they hate their brother. "Don't hate your brother." So I don't see it as he's giving a new law or adding to the law. He's saying this is the way it should have been the whole time.
Yeah, but I mean, there's some truth to that, in that what he was dealing with was the misconceptions or the actions that were present at that time. That's certainly the case. But so many of the things that we're talking about here, whether from the Beatitudes on through, when we get into verses 31 and 32, which again deals with Pharisees' misapplication of God's law in marriage, be an example of that. Nevertheless, he says, "I say to you," and basically, in so doing, abrogates Deuteronomy chapter 24. So, I use the word abrogate correctly, I believe. I hope. So, but where he establishes is that the practice that was allowed and permitted under the old law by command, that is not the way it is any longer, or the way it's going to be with regard to this, and the way it was from the beginning. So there are some things that are involved in that. But these are things that are certainly applicable to us as we establish the new kingdom. The parallels between the old and new law, especially with regard to moral issues like this, are very much the case. I mean, it's what's in the old is in the new as well, so often. And so and let, and perhaps what I'm saying may be misunderstood if you think that I'm saying that you could hate in the Old Testament, but now you can't anymore. That's not the point. You couldn't hate in the Old Testament either. And but he's teaching things that are foundational to his covenant as well. And so that's what I mean by that, at least. But let me just give you a couple of examples that are found in here. And the first one is in this idea of murdering. The you've heard it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder," which of course in this particular case is a discussion of the sixth of the Ten Commandments, which is "Thou shalt not murder," from Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. Whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. Now, what you have is individuals who would never consider murdering, certainly. But what about words said in anger? You notice in verse 22 of the text. And this is kind of going back to what we were talking about of Christ demanding a change of heart and a change of mind that exceeds what the Pharisees were doing, where you find in verse 22, "Whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment." So it's inclusive of that. Again, anger is never acceptable, anger without cause. The naming of names, but is an indication again that we need to be more righteous or exceed the righteousness of what was commonly practiced at that time. The arguments that were being given here, this is what the law requires, and I guess from that, this is all that the law requires when there is either ignoring of other passages or misapplications. And in some cases, we're talking about some things that were traditional. And we'll get into those in a little bit. So let's look at a couple of things. Let me make sure I didn't go over anything too quickly. Okay. All right. So let's continue on looking, first of all, at the word raka. The word raka is an Aramaic term. It is was considered, from what I understand at that time, a great insult, so much so that it would be worthy of being brought before the rulers of the synagogue for judgment. The word raka means empty, mindless, or worthless. Basically, it was an insult, and perhaps an insult that was born out of anger with a brother, because that's the context in verse 22. But you're calling an individual worthless and empty-minded. In fact, there is a parallel. And again, kind of an interesting thing, because you've got raka, which is an Aramaic term, one that would be especially poignant with regard to the Jews' practice. Then you have a Greek term, euphul, which is a different phrase, but basically means the same thing. And again, coming across some of the discussion would be that perhaps there's a perception that raka was not acceptable, but euphul was acceptable, or wasn't as big a deal, because it was the foreign term that was being used. I forget what it was that... I know what it was. One of the commentaries I was reading, the point was made there that that in our society there are a number of Anglo-Saxon terms that, which is of course the primary heritage of the English language, though it's such a hodgepodge, but that whenever those things are said, it's horrific, pornographic, obscene and such, but that there is some acceptance of some of the Latin terms that mean the same things. In other words, it's not considered as bad of an insult as the other. But the word fool is the Greek word from which we get the term moron. And so it's an insult, just like raka is an insult. Basically, they mean the same thing. And so whenever we see these kinds of things that are stated, one of the things to keep in mind is that the Lord is calling upon Christians to have a different mindset and a positive action with regard to their conduct with other individuals. If you're to look at a person who says to another individual, raka or you fool, which is something that Jesus says brings judgment, how are you to act? How do you react to that? And so it's the opposite of that. Insulting language, name-calling, racial, ethnic, social slurs, things that would demean fellow human beings, that's something that God does not accept. Jesus does not accept. As Christians, we need to be seeking reconciliation. Always. So anger, insults, in verses 23 through 24, a difference with a brother that persists. These are kinds of things that are not acceptable. And I think that it's interesting in verse 25 when it talks about someone who's your adversary, while you're on the way with him. So the context here is you're walking along the road toward the judge, and you've got this difference, this dispute with him. Even as it's reached the point to where it's necessary to bring it before a judge. Maybe it's that they are bringing you before a judge. In fact, it kind of seems in the context that may be the case, because he says you need to agree with your adversary before he delivers you to the judge. The judge hands you to the officer and you're thrown into prison. And so the effort needs to be to reconcile. It's always important to reconcile. Now this is something that has its greatest application among brethren, which is why I think that when you see the Apostle Paul, for example, taking issue with the Corinthians, that they were going to law against one another in the church, how horrific that was that they would do such a thing, because they're to be brethren and to be loving toward one another. Jesus is saying it's not even acceptable to have that attitude of strife with anyone in the world, or to be insulted. It's not that it's necessarily going to be possible to be at peace with individuals. It's not that it's not going to be necessary from time to time, as you're brought before the judge, to present the truth and to defend yourself against the accusations that are made against you. It's just that the spirit of strife and anger and conflict that is so present in the world today should never be present in a Christian. We should instead seek to reconcile with one another. Christians must always seek peace, even to the point of seeking peace or negotiating for peace while you're on the way being sued. And try to you get to the bench, try to reconcile with the brother, so that's not necessary. So that's kind of an interesting thing, because some of these things, when it's hyperbole being used when it talks about turn the other cheek and this kind of thing. And perhaps there is, but there are underlining points here that are sufficiently difficult for us to reach as Christians. It takes that complete change of disposition, change of motivation of love, the disposition of peace. It takes the conversion of heart and mind for us to reach that degree of righteousness that the Lord wants us to have. And the world is all around us, and the worldly influences are always there, and it's going to be difficult for us to overcome those things. All right. Yes.
I was taught, just looking back at verse 22 really quickly, I was taught many years ago that this was a progressive statement that Jesus was talking about. When he says that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. The way I take that is that anger is an emotion. If you foment that anger, though, especially without a cause, that would be righteous indignation. That's something else. If you don't have it without a cause and you're fomenting that anger, you're in danger of sinning. You need to tread lightly, because if you're not careful, you will have sinned in the eyes of God. Okay. If you call your brother regularly, you've already sinned. There's no doubt about it. Now you're in danger of civil judgment. If you say we would be better off if you were dead, that's what I was taught the word fool meant.
Okay.
You've gone a step beyond Reka now. Now you're saying it's better if you were wiped from the earth. And apparently that was something that was said back then. Well, now you're in danger of hellfire because you have really done something egregious. Or sin, you're going to be in danger of it anyway if you committed sin. So that seems to make sense to me that's what's going on. But the point, and I kind of agree with what Caroline is saying, is that if you are a Jew under the old law and you have these feelings in your heart for somebody, you sin.
Yeah, it's not
exactly. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah,
and then a lot of these other things he's talking about, you could have committed that sin back then as well, even though the law appears to allow you to do some things. It's interesting that he's not ever actually quoting Scripture, is he? He's always saying, you have heard that it was said.
Some of it is out of the old law. Some of it's not. Yeah. The old law never taught that it was right to hate.
The compilation of statements. Right. Sometimes there is that specific reference, as it was in verse 27. Sometimes it may be a compilation of teachings that are found in the old law that he paraphrases. Other times it would be in a proper interpretation,
or may have been adulterated by the rabbis.
And there was plenty of that was going on in Jesus' time. Good point. Yeah, I wouldn't have a problem with that idea of an escalation in verse 22. As far as in my study, I didn't see that there was a distinction made between rock and you fool as far as amount. Nevertheless, you've got 3 points. It said if you become angry, there's that danger. There can be physical consequences. More importantly, there will be eternal consequences with that persists. And that certainly is an escalation given on this side. So it's a good point to make. Comments, questions? All right. Yes.
Yeah. I think the best lists I hear, part of the list here that gives the idea is when we get down to the section of divorce. Sorry to skip ahead. But one says, also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Then we said in chapter 19, verse 7, they said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away? He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it is not so. I think this really shows far more clearly the idea of there are things going on back then that were not permitted by law. There's never part of the law. Things happen that tradition, other men's ideas of what how it should be came about, and that's what the Jews are practicing at this time. Christ comes and says, that's what might be going on now. But the spirit of law, as we sometimes say when it comes to legal concepts, the spirit of law is never that. I'm trying to bring it back to here's what the spirit of the law is. Here's what the law should have been, or here's what the law is, and what should be practiced, versus what do we see going on in reality.
Yeah, in that specific case, and we'll get into that. I don't know if we'll get into it today or not, but we'll get into it next week if not. But the reference that Jesus makes in Matthew 19 is to Deuteronomy 24, which what Deuteronomy 24 is saying, that if you are going to put away your wife, you need to give her a certificate of divorce before you send her away. But the point of the law was not that, but rather, once you send her away, if the next person she marries, he sends her away, you can't have her back, because that was an abomination to God. So it was a situation where the women were abused, basically, and he was trying to keep that abuse from escalating. And so in that law was not a condoning or endorsement of divorce in any way. It was simply an attempt to mitigate what was already being practiced to make the destructive consequences less than it would be. Again, that's a little bit ahead, so we'll kind of get back to that in just a few moments. We don't have much time, so I do want
there's Romans 7.
We're going to discuss that later too, because that's one of the passages.
Right,
everything's
been said.
Yeah. Let's go to verse 27 through 30, and I'm just going to go through it real quick, and that way we can get the material out there. And if you have anything you want to add at the end, we can. You've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you, for it's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you, for it's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. We cannot cover that in 3 minutes, so forget what I said. Okay, so let me just make a couple of points. There is some misunderstanding with regard to this material. And again, it's so interesting how that so much of the confusion with regard always comes down to the motivation that some have to justify some aspect of marriage for free marriage. It seems like with this section, beginning with verse 21 and going on down, that there is an attempt on part of some to try to get around the teaching of Jesus in this area. But then there are others who will go too far the other direction. And I've actually heard it said that they've committed adultery already in their heart, that that is grounds or cause for divorce, that lusting after a woman would be just cause or just ground for divorce. In verse 32 and 33 of the text, or 31 and 32 of the text, we'll see that that's not the case as we get this discussion underway. But Jesus is discussing here the fact that the heart is involved, as we talked about earlier, when sin is committed. And what we're talking about here is more than just mere temptation. And maybe there's something about that in what Dennis said, going back to verse 22, whoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of judgment. Anger is something that is it's difficult to quell, but we are not to let anger, our sun, well, let the sun go down upon our anger. And if we harbor that, if we act upon it, if we persist in it, then that's something that certainly can be sinful. But what we're talking about here is something that goes beyond. So a woman is dressed provocatively or not, because that really, I guess, makes no particular difference. But a man glances and there is an attraction that is there. What does he do about it? Well, one is temptation, but lust is something far different. It is a mental sin. So anger, lust, hatred, malice, covetousness, envy, jealousy, all of these things are sins. They're mental things, and they're mental things that may not be acted upon. There are a couple of reasons why they may not be acted upon. One of the things that we can make note of is there's no provision for that. You remember with David, the reason why David had provision to fulfill his lust for Bathsheba is that everybody else was gone to war and he stayed behind. He was idle. He had opportunity. The woman's husband is away and he was fighting on his behalf. And so there was that opportunity to fulfill it. If his her husband had been with her, with Bathsheba, he may not have had that opportunity, but he still would have had the lust. And so there's a difference. So the opportunity, it may be social conventions or mores. In other words, I would be shamed if I were to engage in this activity. It may be that the laws of the land might keep me from doing it. The consequences of acting upon my anger or my hatred may be too much for me to do, but the anger and hatred is still there. It may be that I don't steal simply because I already stole and I'm in jail. I want to steal again, but I can't because I'm in jail. You know, there are a lot of things that might preclude it. But where individuals will say, you know, he's okay because he's not done this, 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 and this. If those emotions, those sins are present, not just emotions, but those mental states are present in him, he can be guilty of sin as well. No one can claim innocence if the act is not present and say, I'm innocent, but not if the motivation's there, the improper inside sin is present. And so here it is lust, but no adultery. But Jesus says an individual who has lusted after a woman in his heart, he has committed adultery in his heart. There is no excuse for this. And so in this particular case, there is actually, it's interesting because thou shalt not commit adultery is the seventh commandment. Tenth commandment is you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. So basically here in this text, what he's doing is enlarging upon or commenting on the 10th commandment, which says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is his neighbor's or your neighbor's. So there is that in that section. So what we're going to do is talk a little bit about this controversy that exists just for a moment about, is this grounds for divorce? Lusting after a woman after your heart, and then I'll talk a little bit about this idea of plucking your eye out and cutting your hand off. And we'll do that next week, and then we'll get into a discussion of marriage, divorce, remarriage, beginning at verse 31, 32. I'm hoping that at the end of next week we'll be finished, but I don't think so. It's probably going to be two more weeks before we get through it. But the sixth chapter, if you don't have that material, I think we have some up here if you haven't got it yet, and handouts, and we'll be getting into it as quick as we can. Thank y'all for coming today.